And in retrospect, once one's made the images, I realize, again, I stress it, it hasn't changed anything. But there's a little bit of distance between myself and the action.
Hello, print friends, and welcome. I'm your host, Miranda Metcalf. I release weekly episodes with people around the world who share our love of printmaking. If you like what we do, please rate us and review us on Apple Podcasts. That really does make a difference. Or just tell a fellow print friend about the podcast and maybe they'll enjoy it too. We also have a Patreon page where supporters join at tiers that start at just $1 a month, and that helps to keep us bringing you printy content every week. And you get thank yous like exclusive merch and access to bonus content. Shop talk with our editor, Timothy Pauschak. These are chats for the printmaker's printmaker. They talk about color theory, materials, chemistry, lots of nuts and bolts and down-to-earth professional advice. How do you get a solo exhibition? How do you balance teaching and making? How do you get that teaching gig in the first place? So if that sounds like something you're interested in, you can check out the link in the show notes and sign up to hear Tim's chat with today's guests. And if you want to save a little cash while still supporting the show, you can sign up for a yearly subscription and receive 15% off the tier price. Printmaking forever. Shun the non-believers. This episode of Hello Print Friend is brought to you by Speedball Art Products, who've been offering a diverse range of high-quality products to your creative practice since 1997. But we all know those products do not use themselves, and that's why Speedball works with a fantastic lineup of contemporary printmakers who make up the Speedball team of demo artists. Artists like the incredible Jay Ryan, who's been making screen prints and concert posters in and around Chicago since 1995. His clients have included bands such as Andrew Bird, Fugazi, Hum, The Decemberists, Jack White, Pearl Jam, Modest Mouse, The Melvins, My Morning Jacket, and hundreds of others, as well as brands like Patagonia, Samsung, and CBS Films. Jay owns The Bird Machine, a small screen print shop where he makes all of his prints. So if you want to learn a few tricks of the trade from one of screen printing's best, head on over to Speedball Art's YouTube channel and see how it's done. There's a link in the show notes. Print friends, I have some great news for you. The West Virginia University School of Art and Design's printmaking program is looking for motivated and ambitious artists who want to be a part of their active print community. And between now and the 15th of January, they're waiving application fees for their MFA and MA programs. You might recognize the name West Virginia University from my chats with Bryn Parrott, Olivia Richardson of the Radical Intersectional Printmakers Guild, Stephanie Alanese, and Martin Mazzora, all who studied in the printmaking program there. You can apply for free using the code GRWVU25. Assistantships and waiver hours are also available to incoming students. You can learn more at artanddesign.wvu.edu or check out their printmaking professor, Joseph Lupo, on Instagram at @Lupo_Joseph. If you didn't get your pen and paper or your notes app open in time, do not worry. All of these details are in the show notes. My guest this week is Diane Victor, and print friends, this is a wonderful episode with which to close our third season. Diane speaks incredibly thoughtfully and insightfully about her work and the process of printmaking. We'll talk about her life growing up in South Africa and being a student artist activist in the years leading up to the legal repeal of apartheid, finding ways to get art into non-art spaces, the cathartic nature of printmaking, and the healing power of companion animals. So without further ado, sit back, relax, and prepare to see signs in the smoke with Diane Victor. Hi, Diane. How's it going?
Hi, Miranda. Greetings. Greetings. Good to speak to you.
You too. I am really excited that we have gotten a chance to connect. We have been in several different countries while trying to coordinate, and South Africa and Thailand, and now you're in France and I'm back in the States. But across space and time and pandemics, we've managed to connect. So I'm really looking forward to chatting with you today.
All things happen in the end. You just need eventually the right time and it syncs up, and here we are. Good.
I love it. So I'd like to start out by inviting you to introduce yourself in the way that I invite all the guests to introduce themselves, by just saying who you are and where you are and what you do.
Okay. I'm an artist who works in print and in drawing, in the drawn line, in mark making, I suppose. And I'm a teacher who works at a couple of different institutions. I tend to be a bit of a migrant teacher. I teach printmaking and drawing at a couple of institutions in South Africa, and work on my own. And at the moment, I'm at a studio called Le Grand Village, which is in a very small town, Le Grand Village, close to Limoges and Angoulême, in the center of France. It's a lithography studio run by Francis van der Riet. And I came over here at the end of our teaching year just to come and work on some stones. I come and do litho over here at the studio, and to work on a book project that we're doing here. Oh. So that's where I'm at, and that's what I do.
Wonderful. And then where did you grow up, and what role did art play in that part of your life?
Okay, so I'm very much a South African. I grew up in a small town close to Johannesburg, between Johannesburg and Pretoria, Pretoria being the capital, and Joburg, our main economic center. I grew up in a little village called Halfway House, which is not, and I realize this in American companies, when you say Halfway House, they look at you and raise one eyebrow and say, we're sorry to hear that.
I'm surprised.
But a halfway house in South Africa was a point between two cities where you changed horses. It was a halfway changing point. So it's literally the midpoint between these two cities. So I grew up in a very rural area. And went to university at Witwatersrand, Wits University, in the mid to late 80s. I studied fine arts. And I came into the art world pretty much by chance. I didn't really know much of what I was going to do. And I got into studying art. And the end of the 80s was the height of, well, the height, but it certainly was a stressed point during the apartheid struggles. It was a state of emergency. There was a lot of running warfare on campus. It was a very edgy time to be a student, and to come from this sort of slightly rural environment and shift into an inner city that had all this energy and tension and so much potential for change, and this positive sense that art could make a difference, and that the things could be pushed into a better world. That was really, I think, the drive that pulled me into staying in the art world and also becoming a printmaker. Mm. My belief that printmaking was a medium of the people. You could make it images that could go out to the mass population, not necessarily only to a gallery. Yeah, and that's kind of my background, yes.
Yeah. And so, you know, your work is often categorized, if people are trying to do it in one sentence, as figurative images that address the darker or more difficult sides of South African history and South African contemporary sociopolitical issues. And I was thinking about this. Yes, yeah, so if we can start, you know, start sort of broad, and then we can kind of narrow down. But if you were, you know, born in 1964 and apartheid had its legal repeal in 1991, that means that it's almost exactly half of your life that you've spent in apartheid South Africa and then in the legacy of apartheid in South Africa. And I'm wondering if maybe to kind of set the context for the work that you do, if you could speak to that experience, you know, having your youth and your formative years in this one side
of the experience, mm-hmm. and then, your career and up until now, you know, on the other side of it.
Certainly that would have had a very strong effect on the work that I make. And I mean, you grow up in the environment you are in. You have no alternative to set yourself against. That was just the space you grew up in. Mm-hmm. And for yourself, it was kind of your normality. It was only as one managed to escape from the systems of schooling, which was pretty repressive, and enter a university environment where the sense of not so much a sense of potential, but there was this sense of things were happening and things could be changed. So the imagery that infiltrates and affects my work has always been a reflection of the society. It could only be a reflection of the society I'm part of. Mm-hmm. I sometimes think of myself as being a kind of conduit. A bit like a sponge, you absorb so much of the world around you, and then it kind of leaks out of you into prints or into drawings in some way. And it's your formative, you know, it's what you grew up in. As I say, I can't speak of any other world except that was the world that was my reality. And this sudden feeling of potential, of things were falling, systems were coming down. In Europe as well, and in sort of the East Bloc, the world was changing, and there was such a sense of potential and change. And one had this perhaps idealistic belief that the cultural activity could make a difference, and that being critical and pushing and using images, figurative images, because again of their accessibility, mm-hmm. that making images, documenting what you saw, recording things, making work was just kind of, it needed to be done, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's very easy, well, not easy, but it's easier to say this in retrospect. At the time, one does not think these things through. You're just in, like all of us, you're in a world trying to stay alive and make a living and forge a career. It's not something you pre-plan. I just sometimes, I think in retrospect, when I look at students that I work with now and they're battling to find voices and, you know, things to speak about, that at that time in the late 80s, there was almost no choice, but there was a goal, there was a target, there was such a positive sense of potential of making a difference, and how the power of images and the power of creative voice could really change the way people thought. And that's left an intrinsic impression on, not intrinsic, but it's kind of affected the way I think for the rest of my life. I suppose I've just continued thinking the same way. And after the fall of apartheid and you know, the opening up and freedom in the country, still thinking in that critical sense that almost the images that I make are a record of the time and the place that I am, didn't change. The system changed and it was everything, you know, became so much more positive and better. But still my way of thinking critically and using that to inform my work just continued.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. It's interesting because when you're talking about that time, you're using the word potential. And do you think that you got to see that potential realized, you know, over the course of the career that you've had thus far? Did that kind of manifest in the way that you felt that it could in the late 80s?
I guess we were all so damn idealistic. Isn't one always so idealistic? Yeah. And it's kind of Rainbow Nation and everything would be wonderful. And certainly, yes, the country is in a million times better position in terms of there's freedom for people. But there's always a downside and things always fall apart. And idealism with its little, you know, gold fringed, what is it, fringe around, halo around the edge always tarnishes. And things fall apart and human nature kicks in and corruption, which is one of the main problems in the society we're part of, helps to not necessarily destroy, but it sort of it takes the shine off that hopeful future a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yes, it is a very great place to work in, and I wouldn't really want to ever work anywhere else. But yeah, the need to be critical and the need to look and reflect on the society that you're part of hasn't changed. It still needs to be done.
Yeah.
It still needs to.
Yeah, absolutely. I was actually thinking about this a little bit this morning because I was invited to speak on a panel at an upcoming conference about inclusionary practices. You know, if you're in a position like myself, as I'm sort of a gatekeeper for voices, you know, like I decide what voices get on this podcast that gets listened to by many printmakers. And and I was thinking about how it has to constantly be an active practice, because you don't at one point say, okay, that's it. What I'm making is diverse. What, like, my society is now equal. Like, that's just, it's just never going to happen. It's constantly a moving target that you need to stay critical of and honest about the actual outcomes that you're seeing. You know, not just, I had good intentions, but truly look at what is happening on the other side of those intentions. So, yeah, I completely understand that continual need to engage critically with society and with the own work, your own work that you're creating.
Exactly.
Yeah.
With yourself as well. It's attempting to keep that critical, slightly, I'm not going to say distance, because it's almost impossible to be distance, because you're part of it. It's so, in retrospect, one can always make these comments, but at the time, you're just part of it. It's part of the people around you. But to be critical, constantly critical socially. That's such a negative word, critical. I don't mean it to be excessively negative. It's not that. It's just to keep looking. Mm-hmm. Keep looking, and almost like a seismograph. I often think of, you know, I think of an etched line as this very sharp little sheer line that you etch into metal. And the way a seismograph that measures earth movement or tremors that you would see in a museum, that you just kind of pick up on the tremors. That etching line just reflects the magnitude of things shaking in other places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When I was reading about your work and your background preparing for this interview, I came up over and over again with your work being compared to Bruegel or Bosch. And I think sometimes that can happen to printmakers who are being socially critical. You know, they'll often, people may look back in time and say, oh, just, you know, just like Bruegel, just like. So I was wondering if you identify with that at all, and if you were aware of their work when you were developing your voice and your style at all, or do you think this is a bit of a retrospective fitting to your practice?
If you do art history at university and you are aware of all of these artists and the history of intaglio printmaking specifically, and for the life that does it as well, because of its immediacy and the way you can generate multiples, the idea of printmaking being connected to critical thinking or critiques of society, it has a long history. So I was aware of that. But again, it's something you come to in retrospect. When you're making, or for me, when you're making at the time, you're not thinking that way. I get angry. I tend to make work more effectively. Or when I'm angry or something's really either upsetting or bugging me, and it's a way to draw it out of yourself. So it's kind of like almost drawing a thorn out of your finger. And drawing an image is a way for me to think through what's going through my head. So that kind of imagery is just sort of what I do, without thinking, how do I position this within you? Certainly in some bodies of work, I've consciously gone and said, okay, how does this relate to perhaps another body of work that's been made in the past? But normally it's far more of an intuitive process. I would not make any idea of having preconceived ideas of going out to do things. I get angry. I want to work. An image needs to be made, and I either work directly in drawing, which is the other medium extensively, or it moves into print.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting what you're saying about how the impetus for the creation can come from a place of anger. And, you know, knowing the subject matter of your work, I'm guessing that's that you hear a story or you learn about something, you see something in the news. And I think that particularly in the States in recent years, people can really, really identify with that. You know, seeing something that seems so blatantly unjust and feeling so helpless, feeling just that impotent rage of feeling like I am subject to this, and more marginalized people than myself are subject to this. And so I'm wondering if you could speak to that transfer of taking that energy, because that anger can feel so, at least for me, it can almost feel disempowering. Like, it can feel sort of out of control, and like I can go towards hopelessness in it when it feels sort of overwhelming. But it sounds like you found a way to channel it into creation and into art that is doing some work in society.
I guess that's the hope.
Yeah.
That you're doing some work. Because that's what it is. It's disempowering. You feel impotent. It's, one gets so angry. And the anger, I can only speak from my own position. If I don't draw it out of me, it kind of loops in the circle inside yourself, mm-hmm. and you reactivate it, and then you're angry again, and then you get upset, and then you're ranting and raving to yourself, and it's a destructive energy. Internalized, it's a destructive energy. And I learned it when I was being a child, as enjoying things that made me angry. So it's a very intuitive, almost childlike way of working, in that I draw it out, I make, and it's not political cartoon. It's not going and saying, okay, I'm going to parody a certain situation. But it's drawing what's in my head, because I'm not a very good words person. I'm an image person. My brain functions in images. It has a running visual commentary going through it, not a verbal one. And allowing that anger to be transferred onto a surface doesn't make it any better for the situation. I know that. There's no delusions that it changes the world. But it allows me to mediate it through that process. I draw it, I make it, and I communicate far more succinctly through the drawn line than I ever can. I mean, that's why I think so many artists go into making, is they're just not really good at talking. Mm-hmm. You produce this image, and it's an image that then goes out into the world. And it's your voice or comment on that situation goes out into the world, and people can respond to it. Either it triggers anger in them, which is not a problem. It's at least a response. But it's a way of vocalizing my own disquiet and thinking through things that anger me. And in retrospect, once one's made the images, I realize, again, I stress it hasn't changed anything. But there's a little bit of distance between myself and the action. You might be, and often we do a lot of driving. I work between the two different cities, and I spend maybe a couple of hours a day in a car moving between different jobs. And you'll have the news on and some incident, and it'll be exactly the same in the States or in many countries around the world. Some incident comes up, and it's just, you get so angry. And I keep a small workbook next to me in the car. And I do working drawing, because images flash through your head. And it's process. So much of making, and I think so much of printmaking, is about process as well. But it's that first step of process, from energy goes into the image. Mm-hmm. And it's like a conduit. It runs into the image. And there's a slight distance from yourself. And from there, it's processed through the printing, through the etching, through the process of print. Mm-hmm. And it moves it a little bit away from the immediacy of one's own frustration.
Yeah, because working in print, you would have so much more time with that image. You know, so you do your initial sketch, but then you need to rework it, you need to work your plate, you need to make your proofs. Is that sort of all part of the catharsis for you, would you say?
Totally. Mm. And printing, I mean, in terms of etching, intaglio, which is the main medium that I work in, certainly do my own printing, is this long, slow process. You can't rush a print. Mm-hmm. And it's that you can't. And there's a great amount of pleasure that occurs in printing itself, physical pleasure of polishing, of wiping a plate. It's a mechanical routine that you go through. And people say, oh, we're going to the gym to go and do training. Yeah. I don't go to the gym, but if I'm going to go and print half an edition today and it's, you know, 20 prints, it's the equivalent of going through a gym, but it's a very physical but also cathartic process of birthing these images from a plate, and they're there and they exist, and you step away and you put them to bed in the drying racks. And there they sleep, and you wake them up later, and they've kind of come out of you. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's so interesting. I've never thought about that connection of the physicality of printmaking with emotional catharsis. And I think that there's a lot of understanding now, you know, really in the last decade, about how our bodies process trauma, mm-hmm. and how even hearing news stories, our bodies don't understand that we're not really experiencing what we're hearing about. Mm-hmm. And so we can feel that trauma and then it will live in our body until we get a chance to process it through physical exercise or hysterical crying or something. And that you can actually use the physicality and the repetitive nature and the almost meditative nature of printmaking to help with that. That's fascinating.
Exactly. Grinding a stone, grinding a lithostone, polishing a plate, even wiping a plate. It's actually incredibly gentle and quite a caressing process. It's a strange thing. There's definitely a link.
Yeah. So you've taken on a project that you've called the Disasters of Peace, which if it's still in process, it's going to be the 20th year, I think.
at least 20th year.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it is still going on. I initially started the series as a direct response to Goya's Disasters of War, and many artists have responded to that amazing series. And I started working on it about 2001, and it was, there were just, as there are in so many societies, bizarre incidents happening, and I was so angered by them. We lived in and still do live in this country with this amazing constitution. We have one of the most enlightened and wonderful constitutions in the world, which offers freedom to society. It's really a generous document. And yet within this wonderful environment, barbaric situations occur, which one would normally only associate with an environment or a country at war with another country or at war with itself. And that's really what it became, a society at war with itself, where it started almost like the destructive process of chewing your fingernails or some kind of damaged action against self. And I started off with the first 10 or 12 plates using similar format and also working in etching, producing images responding to specific incidents that you'd hear or read about in the newspaper, you'd hear on the radio, or people that I'd know, situations that had occurred to them or to myself, and just producing this document of the time. And unfortunately, and I do say that with much stress and unfortunately, it's just continued because it's my coping process. So it is to an extent perhaps a crutch that I'm inflicting on the world. I do think of that sometimes. It's rather self-indulgent. I get rid of the cathartic things that I don't like and then I multiply them and give them to people. But it just continued because exactly the same thing. I mean, I'm sure many artists around the world are working with very similar subjects. It's just continued. And we're now at about 42, 43 plates. I've got a lot of plates in process. I get back to them when there's time and I generate the working drawings. Yeah.
And are each one in a direct response to a specific plate from the Disasters of War, or is it just sort of more of a general feeling and response?
It wasn't a response to their specific plates. I literally took the idea lifted the idea of Goya working with an environment of conflict during the Franco-Spanish war and producing these images about the conflict that he was seeing. And with the idea that I live in a country at peace, a country at peace with itself, yet waging war on its own citizens. It's chewing itself up and just started making images again without any. I'm really incredibly intuitive. I don't plan things. It's a very bad habit and it gets me into, I wish I did plan things a lot better. I just tend to start stuff and then it's like, oh, and we're still doing them. So they just respond to individual incidents. Something crazy comes up and you hear about a guy being tied to the back of a police van for punishment for driving on the wrong side of the road in his taxi and then being dragged behind the police van. And then, next thing he's dead. And it's a barbaric action that, again, it shouldn't be happening anywhere in the world, and yet it is, and therefore an image just kind of leaks out of me. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that from my perspective as someone who grew up in the States, and, you know, I was born in 1984, and so I have very early memories of the end of apartheid and the news made around the world, and it was this incredible celebration. And then so in school, at least the history that I was taught was that the South African people worked very hard and Nelson Mandela's incredible, and then it ended and everyone lived happily ever after.
Which is how all fairy stories work. And then the rainbow was shining. But in reality, I mean, it definitely was the most wonderful thing, and a huge, huge, I'm going to say improvement, such a ridiculous word in this context. But yet within that, not everything changed. Mm-hmm. In fact, certain things changed, and on paper things changed. But societies don't change when you change the documents. And it takes so long for mindsets to shift. And again, when corruption and greed sets in, so much of the goodwill and good intentions leach away into other pockets, and a large percentage of our population are still in an equally disadvantaged position they were 20 or 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And that's the frustration. And it's the same, again, in so many societies. In the States, in everywhere, it's always these situations. It's just,
yeah.
There was so much hope. There was so much hope, and there still is a very positive feeling in many ways, but one, if one does not continue to be critical and keep looking critically, you don't keep pushing. Mm-hmm. It slides.
Yeah, and it reminds me, I think, just a little bit of the U.S. history. And of course, you know, the Civil Rights Act, and that we suddenly got this sheet of paper that said, now no one can treat anyone badly based on the color of their skin. And then it's like, and the story certainly is not, and then no one ever did again. Like, it's, as you say, it's we can set the ideals down, and it's so important to have those legal documents and to have the express will of a nation saying that we are saying that these are our values. But of course, societies do not respond immediately.
Not overnight. Mm. They drag their heels and they resist and they slip and they, it's human nature. That's what it is. It's not a specific African situation. It's just the country that I live in. And as I say, the work that I make could have been made in any number of country. It's the place I live and the place I work.
Yeah. So something that I found when I was, again, you know, researching you and your work and what had kind of already been written about it, which I do before I sit down with an interview, is I at one point had to admit to myself that I was doing a lot of reading about your work, but I wasn't looking at a lot of your images. And I think it's because they're hard. Like, they're beautiful. Like, you're an incredible draftsperson. But I was had this subconscious thing of they are disquieting to engage with. And so I realized, I think I kind of almost had this subconscious thing where I wasn't spending this time really looking. Yeah. And I try to, when I am doing this research, I really try to make the work be the core of where my own inquiry is and where the stories is coming from. So I had to sort of check myself and go back and really look at your incredible body of work that's out there. And it made me wonder if, you know, dealing with difficult truths and difficult facts about the world and human nature, and doing so, you know, with images that carry the emotional weight of those difficult truths, have you found in your career a kind of resistance at all from people, of from either gallerists or critics or teachers or mentors, you know, to
family?
Yeah.
I think on that level, definitely, I'm aware of it. You make an image that doesn't make people happy, or it makes them uncomfortable. And that really is, to a large extent, my intention. Mm. It's to almost be a slight, a nagging tap in the side towards indifference. There's nothing that irritates, also a very light word, angers me more than people whose attempt to be indifferent to a situation. So yes, there has been some resistance, and a lot of people think of me as, oh, she's very negative. And I'm actually not a particularly negative person. I don't think I'd be able to make the images if I was. It's my way of dealing with information. And there's a lot of, and this is again when one sometimes needs to look at imagery quite carefully, but it does also require knowledge of the context where I'm coming from. There's a lot of very dark humor in the work. In fact, there has to be. I suppose the term would be gallows humor. And it's not to make light of a situation, but it's that one survives. The sun also rises. One moves on. And It's something that if I don't make the works, gnaws a hole in me. It's like a corrosive process. And unfortunately, it's just what I impose onto people in the world. And if they do not like the work, they don't look at them, and that's fine. And I have very often run into people who come and challenge me on saying, but why are you making these images and what are you doing and that? And for me, it opens, hopefully, opens chance to have a conversation about something. I'd rather have a conversation with somebody on the vague hope that it might change or get them to question slightly in the position that they think, or that sounds very egotistical, arrogant, but to get them to think through what it is they find offensive, than indifference, or people just going like, oh, those are nice, we really like your itch. At which point I would go and change what I do, because I wouldn't be doing the right thing. It's being that little corrosive, almost like a warning sign, just corroding away at people's psyche, saying, but guys, keep on looking. Because I do realize we're bombarded, and we all know this, we're bombarded with visual imagery. Mm-hmm. And with social media being so effective as it is, people become numb and slightly more so now than historically, able to switch off to things they don't want to look at. And my students, I mean, I don't have kids, but I teach, as I said before, a number of institutions, and I almost see the students that I teach as my inverted commas surrogate children. So I learn through their, and I think teaching is a privilege. I get to see through their way of thinking. And they'll skim through the feed on their cell phones, and there'd be some horrific images. Mm. And they just say, oh, we just don't look. I'm like, how can you just not look? I don't have that.
Yeah.
Ability built into my head. I can't not look. Mm. But it interests me in people's coping strategies of dealing with excessive violence or horror in their society with which they have to encounter on a daily basis, and their survival tactics of not seeing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That ability to not look varies so much person to person. I've always been someone myself who can't not look. You know, I was just an incredibly sensitive child. I would have panic attacks learning about the Holocaust and have to be taken out of class when I had other students who were so bored they were throwing pencils in the ceiling sitting next to me. Like, I always had that. How can people not be responding to these things that happen to real humans in the world? And in my life, I've just met people who really can just say, oh, I just don't think about that, you know?
No. Like, and it amazes me. And they switch off. Mm-hmm. I don't think about it. It doesn't affect me personally. But it's not an off switch that you have. It sounds like it's very similar to my, if something horrific happens, it circles in my head until I draw it out of myself. It doesn't go away, but it mediates it.
Yeah. And I think that's ability to switch off, you know, through receiving information as people are used to, you know, seeing it on Twitter, hearing it on the radio on the way into work. And I think that is a place where art can be an active force, is that if you're producing images, if you're producing a visual language around things that are happening that maybe people haven't developed a resistance to yet, or maybe they... Or maybe your images can be imbued with an emotional reality that goes beyond just hearing the facts stated to you. That in that place, you can kind of invite or maybe even force people to engage emotionally and to actually feel what is happening and what is happening to real live humans who are also in this world with us, who are just like us, who are going through things and who have families who have to deal with the aftermath of it. Yeah.
Exactly. It's almost, well, it's not tricking, but I've often thought that working with technically beautiful or beautifully made images that are visually enticing, so to deal with difficult subject matter, but to draw it in a way that's visually seductive. So people go, oh, well, this is an amazing image. It's a terrible thing, and it sounds like I'm making light of it, but I'm aware, very aware of the fact, incredibly aggressive image, and something I've learned from experience in years of something really aggressive that stands out there, and you lose your view from about, you know, 5 meters. They take one look, and you can see the shutters going down, and they're like, I'm not going there. And realizing that this is also where printmaking can work as well, especially etching, because of the scale being quite small and intimate, and that you pull people in to an image, and it's not entrapment, but it's just, it's a dialogue, it's a visual dialogue. And they come in and they look, and then they see something, and then they start thinking. And hopefully, once they've started looking and thinking, you've opened that line of conversation rather than just making a judgment and stepping away. I know it's idealistic. All these little bells are going off my head while I'm speaking to you. I can hear my conscience going like, oh, yeah, really? You preach to the converted. You're speaking to a gallery audience, and when people coming into a show know what to expect. But I really do also attempt to move images out of gallery environments into other spaces, showing in other spaces where people come into work, come in to see works when they're accidentally going into a butcher or something like that, and they come into context with works that they wouldn't expect in another environment, and then hopefully lines of communication. Yeah.
Mm. And so you do seek out places to show your work that's not the traditional white-walled gallery art context. Can you speak to that?
Well, it's you get spaces where you're allowed to, but I'm more and more thinking that so much of where you show is part of the work. Recent installation that I did was in the stairwell of, it wasn't a university, so again, it's a privileged environment that you're speaking to an educated body of society, but using the stairwell to hang, I do smoke drawings on glass. I know this is a printmaking talk and I'm diverging slightly, but I do smoke drawings on glass, and then hanging these glass smoke drawings with the shadows of the glass projected onto the walls of the stairwell. So people using the stairwell would come across these shadow stains, and they were portraits of women who'd been murdered by their intimate partners. And as you climbed the stairs, you came across these stains. They couldn't see the glass or the smoke drain. They could just see the projected shadows. And it kind of, people stopped and tried to rub them off the wall because this wasn't a gallery environment.
Yeah.
And that was the amazing thing. They wanted, their hands went up. They wanted to interact. I did an installation of portraits of, or portraits is an open term, the portraits of the heads of animals that had been cut off, abattoir, and then hung them in a butcher's environment. So when you came in to go and buy the meat, there were these little ghosts portraits of probably somebody you were eating.
Yeah.
Just shifting them into spaces where people didn't expect, moving artwork into other spaces, other environments. Any chance that I get, I try and move it. Not only, Sydney's still working within the gallery environment, but trying to find other spaces.
Oh, I love that. When I was working in Bangkok before everything got very severely locked down. I was working as a director of a gallery out there, and the owner of the gallery and I would often talk about how we really wanted to get art out of gallery spaces. And it was so exciting. And particularly, I think in a place like Thailand where, there's not as kind of established culture of going to galleries that sort of many people do, and so really to bring art into unexpected places, and it's Thailand is a place that is deeply divided by social class. Many places are, but it's very very visual in many parts of Southeast Asia. So then everything got locked down, and then I moved back home. So it never happened, but it is something that I really am excited whenever people talk about it. And
it doesn't mean it can't happen in the future.
Yeah.
Things will change. COVID changes. Things will change. You go back. There's always potential to go. But I agree totally. Moving images into spaces where people who do not have the time or the privilege to go into a gallery come in contact with. So it's a communication, which is again where printmaking really has that advantage. You can work in the multiple. And if you're not printing on the best quality paper and you're printing on another format, and I know this again goes against where galleries like to pitch themselves, but you can put images out into, you just wallpaper them up on the walls. You can print them another way.
Yes, I had a great chat a few months ago with Caledonia Curry, who's known as Swoon here. I'm not surprised that you know her work. I think that there's some similarities in motivation between your two practices. But, you know, she started as a street artist. And mm-hmm. one of the things she talked about when we chatted was the fact that because she could do this multiple, she could put up these images of people all over the city, and she didn't have to worry about if someone tears it down or tags over it or throws paint on it, because she can keep making them, and she can keep making on them on this relatively inexpensive paper, putting them up quickly, and then they're there in people's lives, you know, as they're walking to the subway and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So it's printmaking is incredible that way, and part of the reason why printmaking and printmakers, I think, tend to be politically engaged and empathetic mm-hmm. and wanting to move the needle of social change very often is it and because you go back, you know, to Goya and being able to produce these multiple images of the disasters of war, although I don't think they were, you know, I don't believe that they were printed in his lifetime.
No, I don't think
yeah.
so.
Mm-mm. But he was making them. Yeah, he knew, and that when they were produced, they were these honest images of what actually happens in war out there mm-hmm. in the world for people to see. And it was it's incredible impact that what printmaking can have. It's wonderful. I was
a document. Document of a time where obviously now photography and the access we all have to cell phones and photography does shift the position, but it's the mediated quality of a drawing. It's not just a photo of, once it's run through your brain and your hands and the process, it becomes something else. It does. It changes in conversation or translation. It's not lost in translation. It translates into a distilled, anyway, yeah.
No, I think that's so important, that idea of the way something that's created by a human hand pulls our attention in a way that I think, because we're so saturated with photography, you know, mm-hmm. now it just doesn't, you know, I mean, I see more photographs before breakfast than my mm-hmm. grandmother would have seen in a year. And so we do become immune to that, but when something, as you say, gets mediated through human craft, human intervention, we're just fascinated by seeing something that was made by another hairless ape, you know. We just love it. We just see it and we're like, oh, what is that? And in just in a way that it is important, and I think it does pull attention in a world that we're increasingly competing for attention, even the slightest sliver of it.
Mm-hmm. which also deadens things. I think that's it, when there's so much and so much background visual noise that people become quite blind, again, as we spoke earlier, possibly as a coping strategy. Mm-hmm. But that seeing in a drawn image or an etched or whatever, a made image, you don't realize it, but you also understand the maker's reasons and mindsets in a non-verbal way. We've got a strong visual intuition. Mm-hmm. You look and you understand without having to verbalize and say, as you would in a lecture, this is what I see. You kind of intuitively read an image.
Absolutely. And I've always been so, I just love that intuitive place that visual images can touch, and the place beyond words, and the way that a visual image isn't linear in the way that you take it in, the way words, you have to put one in front of the other in order for things to make sense. But you can get so much at once when an image is really doing its job, you know, really communicating. You can see it, and you can see beauty and horror simultaneously in a way that you just can't with words. Yeah,
you can't with words. And there's the limits of financial and education and privilege and language are gone. Mm-hmm. You look at the image, and doesn't matter what your home language is, you read it. Mm-hmm. And that's, I suppose, the strength of the power of the visual image.
Yeah.
And the man, and the handmade, and the man-made. I hate that gender word. The maid.
Yes, the maid. Yeah, absolutely. I am curious to circle back to the exact circumstance you're talking about, having images of beheaded animals in a butcher shop, because it's been my experience often that people who are butchers or who work in the meat industry, they're not usually keen to remind people of where their meat comes from. Yeah. So how did that come about, that you found a butcher shop that would put up that kind of work?
Well, I suppose that there were drawings, and there were drawings in smoke. And smoke drawing is a very gentle process. You're just basically drawing. So they became very beautiful portraits. They were just the heads, and it wasn't showing the gory section of severed sinews. It was just the heads of the dead, a bit like something was Delacroix, I think it was, who did those studies of decapitated heads, which were quite horrific, but they were also very beautiful. And it was a small town that had an arts festival going on, and I went in there and I approached the butcher, and then I explained how the process had been made. And there's one thing about smoke drawings as well, is that it almost has a slightly, the dog and pony component. It's sort of like almost magic. Oh, look, I can take a candle and make an image. Mm-hmm. And they were quite intrigued. And the amazing thing was they were hung in this butcher store. And when clients, what's the right word for a butcher, came in, if there was some time, the butcher would explain the process and was wildly enthusiastic and excited about having these images in his space, because they were ghostly. They were actually very sad little images, but none of the horror of the actual butchering. They were really just the ghosts of lost animals. And they didn't see it as a negative thing, and I didn't see it as a negative thing. It was just trying to, so when you're walking into, the local butcher and you want a pound of mince, that if there's an image of perhaps the sheep that it came from, or just the portrait of its head floating above there, you don't think of it in a horrific way. It's just that memento mori of this is the context.
Mm-hmm.
And the first butcher I approached was quite open to it. And and the work was shown there. Mm-hmm. And had a very interesting response. Many people just really couldn't give a damn because they were there in a hurry and they were there to do what they needed to do. But a number of people actually stopped and asked and looked. And there wasn't a negative reaction. I asked him to sort of record if there was anybody who commented.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a negative reaction. There was just this curiosity of, oh, okay.
Yeah.
I suppose if there'd been photographic images again, too abrupt and too raw, but mediated through making and through materials, again, the importance of the material you work with, as adding another layering to the reading of the work, kind of, and you don't need an arts degree to access works like that.
Mm.
We sometimes assume the elitism of arts degrees that allow people to access work, but everyday public are quite visually able to look and read and understand.
I some of my favorite conversations I've ever had about art, and I've worked in several commercial galleries now over the last 10 years, and so I do sometimes act as the first the first line, the first line that people encounter, there are all kinds of social barriers to going into art galleries, thinking they're not for you, the 9 to 5 hours that they keep and this sort of thing, but it is free and open to the public, and so you do sometimes have people come in who haven't had any sort of formal training in reading visual images, and those can be such interesting conversations, because it's the way people respond to work without all of that background can be really pure and really insightful and extremely interesting. And how does someone react to an image if they've never heard of Goya that's referencing Goya? And it's very fascinating, and so I love that idea, and
real and important, actually almost more important, and I'm not in any way being negative towards the galleries, but towards your informed viewer who comes in, who knows the background and reinforces the value of the work, again preaching to the converted. But having somebody who comes in and honestly gives you a response and a question of, but why are you doing this? It's ugly. Why don't they have clothes on? It's very often a question I'll get. So why don't they have clothes on? It's great because it puts you in a position to think as well, and not to take for granted the liberties that the art world allows you, and think, okay, so I'm dealing with the real world as well, and I need to actually be more self-critical, and why am I making these images? And I'm not out to offend everybody. Yeah, so it's for me a really important thing as well, getting that real pushback.
Yeah. And I think that also putting people in a position where they are uncomfortable, and if you can get them to examine that, like that is incredible. Mm-hmm. And it is in the discomfort that we find space to grow. I believe that very much. And I say this as someone who often when I'm in discomfort, I'm just completely absorbed in and self-pity and woe is me and can't be philosophical mm-hmm. about mm-hmm. it. But in retrospect, you can look back and you can say, oh, that is when I had to grow. And there's a writer who writes about sort of end of life care through a Buddhist context. And mm-hmm. he talks about, can you be curious about your pain? And mm-hmm. I mm-hmm. often try and think of that, you know, that so rather than just the, this is happening to me and it's the worst thing that happened to anyone. And, you know, these mm-hmm. sort of mm-hmm. very human thoughts of this narrative that comes from the ego. But to be like, wow, like I am having a really strong reaction to this image. Mm-hmm. Why? You know, if you can move into that mm-hmm. space of curiosity, I think it's incredibly powerful. And we need images in the world that make us uncomfortable to invite us to do that. Yeah.
It's the role of the cultural worker. We need images, we need movies, we need dance, we need theater, we need writing that does that, that pushes you to a point of disquiet beyond one's comfort zone. And then in that different space you go, oh, okay. Am I forced to think about that? Yep. It's the role of the creative worker, I suppose.
Yeah.
Right word being worker, because that's what it is. It's just work, like collecting the waste. It is. It's mm-hmm. just work.
It's physical labor. And it's I taught one semester of introductory to art history during my graduate work. And that was always one of the really fun things to, you know, blow the kids' minds with is when you tell them that, you know, painters used to be thought of as cabinet makers. You mm-hmm. know, we now have this magical narrative about genius artists who, you know, use their God-given talents to magically push society forward. But for a very, very, very long time, if you worked with your hands, you were a worker, you were a laborer, you were a craftsperson. And it didn't matter if that was making armor or cabinets or butchering a hog or mm-hmm. making mm-hmm. an etching. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. You're a craftsperson. You used your craft. And then it became a dirty word, but it became a problematic word and then the art world. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it moves into different places now, but still you make with your hands, you make with your eyes. Mm. You're a visual communicator, a worker.
Yeah.
Not what every artist would like to agree with and perhaps contest and argue, but yeah, that's my certain belief that it is.
Yeah, definitely. I did have a question that I feel like maybe you've already addressed, but I would maybe like to hear you speak to it a little bit more, which has to do with when you're working in the darker side of human experience, mm. how do you kind of take care of your own mental health? And I ask this, and I say that you may have already addressed it and that it sounds like creating the images is a part of taking care of your mental health. But you are still spending a lot of your life in the weeds of that darkness. And I do think that is so important for artists to be able to make those images, but also keep up their strength so they can continue to do it. And maybe if you can just kind of speak to how it affects you or if you have practices around it that help keep you going so you can continue to make the good work that you make.
I suppose by making it, and we did discuss it, by making it, it is my way of dealing with these things because they're there the whole time. But if I don't make, that's when they really become problematic for me because they kind of corrode a hole, or not a hole, but they kind of rot inside you. It sounds very bizarre to say that, but they need out. But the things that I do, and I'm somebody who really enjoys physical outdoor activities, going hiking, going riding. I used to be a more serious runner. I still run. I need to do physical things. I'm somebody who's very aware of the fact that my physical body needs to go and do something where it's active and working. Going for a ride, and it's a privilege or a luxury of owning a horse, going for a ride and being immediate with an animal.
Yeah.
And I'm also somebody who has a lot of animals and the privilege again of living at home with animals. It just kind of, it levels things and it brings back to reality. And you're there in the now and your body's fitness and strength is what matters. And if you sit and worry too much about what you're thinking about, you're either going to come off the horse or you're going to trip when you're running and you have to be in your body and there. So I do a lot of outdoors activities is probably my best way of mediating the stressiness of, you would know, when you're doing etching, it's a very fine, you tend to tense up. You're doing a lot of this. I'm drawing and you're focused, and I'm focused and I'm thinking about what I'm drawing, and there's that anger goes through your head, down your arm and out your fingers into this plate. And if I don't go and do something like go for a run, I find that you start getting, your body tells you. It's an animal that tells you, I'm not happy. There's too much things that you mentioned earlier. I agree totally. Your body knows there's stress, but it can't react to it by running away. And it doesn't fully comprehend the stress is driven by something you've heard on a radio. And a way to help myself overcome that is through my contact with friends, through students, and with doing physical things.
Yeah.
Out doing stuff. Yeah. Working.
Yeah. And I completely connect with what you're saying about that, that healing power of animals and how they are present and they know when you're not present. And they keep you honest in that. And I really, really adore that. And I very much believe in that having other animals help us connect with our presence and our animalness. And yeah, I think that's a wonderful point to sort of wrap up our conversation on.
The importance of animals, companion animals, and the fact that you never have to think through the alternative motives.
Yeah.
They are there and they do what they do and they're totally honest to why they're doing it.
Absolutely. I had an incredible conversation once with a woman who runs a funeral home for animals.
Oh, wow.
And she said that she basically, you know, ends up also, of course, being therapist a lot of the time, too, because people come in with their grief. You know, she says she's seen people just hysterically crying over gerbils and they need to process it. And I completely understand it. And she said one thing that she's found is really helpful for people is that they'll come in, and a lot of times, especially with dogs or cats, you know, these real domesticated companions, they'll say that they have so much guilt because they're feeling worse than when their father died or when their mother died or when their aunt died. And one of the things she says is that, you know, a dog never is not happy to see you. A dog never takes out their bad day on you. A dog never blames you for something that you haven't done. And she said, holds a grudge. Exactly.
And she said,
it's okay to have a purer grief about animals because you do have a purer love, a less complicated love with them. And I just think that ever since I heard that, I think about it all the time with when I'm interacting with my dogs, or I rode horses for just about a year back when I was living in Seattle, and just that honesty and that presence that they have is so incredible. Yeah, so important.
It's so important, and our contemporary life becomes more and more complicated, and that absolute straight, direct honesty becomes harder and harder to find in our human interaction, where nothing ever is as straight as it appears to be.
Yeah.
But if that horse doesn't like you, the horse doesn't like you.
Yeah. It's not good. Especially with horses. They have opinions. Yeah.
They do. Good.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, can you please let people know what's the best place to find you out on the internet if they wanted to see your work or follow anything that you're up to?
Oh God, this is where I'm really bad. I spend my life making images and being a very bad social networker. I have an Instagram site, Diane.Victor.
Okay.
And you can, you know, the best thing to do, I don't even have a website. I'm terrible. I'm trying to think of the best way to say this. Go out, just put my name in a search, and images will come up. And through the different galleries, I show through the images, through Le Grand Village. Mm-hmm. They certainly have websites, David Crit, Goodman Gallery. There's all these places that are there, and they will find images.
Wonderful.
But I'm not organized enough to say beyond Instagram to go anywhere.
I think that's perfectly fine. Yeah, I think that you're findable out there. So I think that that's what matters. Yeah.
I'm findable. If you're looking for the images, they will find the viewer.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much, Diane. I've had an incredible time chatting with you about everything. And I'm so pleased that we were able to connect and have this talk.
Miranda, thank you. And I really enjoyed speaking to you. That was great.
Wonderful.
Was great.
And you're going to stick around and have a little shop talk with Tim, correct?
Certainly, that's what we're going to do.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you again.
Okay, go well.
Well, that's our show for this week. Join me again next week when we'll have an announcement about your print friends over here at the pod, and we'll start our annual trip down memory lane with a few favorites from the archives for the end of the year. You won't want to miss it. This episode, like all episodes, was written and produced by me, Miranda Metcalf, with editing by Timothy Pawshak and music by Joshua Weber. I'll see you next week.